This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined again by a special guest tonight. We've got three sponsors for the show, the first being Jam Software, who provide IT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technology such as Mac, iPad, iPhone, and Apple TV in education. More about them at jamsoftware.com. This show is also brought to you by Shobi, an iPad app for paperless classrooms. Shobi makes it easy to assign, collect, and review student work, and provide rich feedback with annotations, voice notes, and more. And finally, this show is sponsored by XMA and the HP Chromebooks 11 and 14. And we'll tell you more about all of those as the show goes on. So I want to introduce tonight Dan Edwards, who's somebody I've been in touch with for a little while. Dan, I think we met the first time, just in person for the first time in January in London this year. And I think we're going to have a good chat tonight. Dan is the Director of Digital Strategy at the Stephen Peirce Foundation Schools in Cambridge. So Dan, welcome to the show.
Hi, Fraser. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. So Dan, can you give us a little bit of your kind of background in education and what you've done in relation to technology, just in general terms, and we'll get into some details later on.
Yeah, no problem at all. Yeah, I always stress to people that I'm a PE teacher by trade, which often shocks people a little bit because of all the technology stuff I talk about now. But really, I was driven to technology by a lack of time. So as a PE teacher, all those fixtures in the evenings and not enough time with my students, could never get to them at lunchtimes. And I happened to get a MacBook a fair few years ago, just when the iPad 2 came out, and there was a deal to have the iPad 2 at the same time. Okay. So took it into school, said to the sixth form kids that kind of trusted me a little bit, let's have a look at this, did some presenting with it. Then they started to get their phones out, give a little bit of feedback. Then I realized that I could do a lot of good stuff with things like Edmodo and doing some screencasting, admittedly at the time, on the Mac. Got a bit of workflow going, and that led to a trial with iPads, and it went on from there. Like I say, it was interesting how I had a number of drivers for myself more than anything else.
So it was mainly about sort of personal productivity as a teacher and then completely bringing that into the classroom.
Yeah, absolutely. And also a little bit of positivity from some guys that, you know, I took for these sports teams that sort of egged me on a little bit.
Okay. So in terms of just to, I suppose not everybody will be that familiar with the way that PE is taught in the higher grades in the UK, but how does that relate? I mean, I think most people think of PE as actually doing sport, but how does that look just in terms of what you do in the classroom or outside the classroom?
Absolutely. And it's quite obvious to most people that the fact that we've got a camera on an iPad and we're doing our core skills and we've got skills analysis going on, that all works very well. We used to spend thousands on that. Yeah. But when it comes to your GCSE and A-level, the fact of the matter is there are a number of different components that students have to meet that you have to grade. And the fact that we can now receive many different file types and give written or annotated comment on that is an absolute godsend. And that's something that we really struggled with, you know, all sorts of things like videotape, then sort of DVDs, and not being able to give feedback. So you give them written feedback, which doesn't really relate to the content. And you have to tell them to forward and forward and back on all their DVD stuff. So it really does translate very well that you can use any of the platforms now for great workflow. And you can receive all those different contexts and give feedback. So that's where it stands. And then a really powerful thing is because these devices are in the children's hands, we've got their ability to annotate, talk over, explain. So when you receive the final product, it's not just the written word, which is what it was for a decade for me.
And I've certainly done presentations on this kind of topic using video feedback and things like that. Do you find that you're getting a much richer understanding of what the children both can do but also understand?
Yeah, I think the most obvious thing for me is the fact that when you're preparing for the next lesson, you feel much more informed because you've got the inflection of their voice. You've actually got them pointing to the thing they didn't understand, and they've had to reflect on that much better than perhaps they would with the written word as well. And then secondary to that is when you do have those one-to-one conversations that we're always striving for, because that's definitely the best way of teaching if you can get that time. You feel like you are more informed to start the questioning at the right level as opposed to finding out about actually where they are.
Yeah, so you don't have to do a sort of consultation for 5 minutes and then
there you go
offer your advice after that. Yeah,
that's right.
Well, that's interesting because I do a similar thing. I mean, the listeners will know with presentation skills. So we use video in there and video feedback and workflow. And it's very interesting because the kids will sometimes argue with you about what happened during their presentation until you show them the video. And then it's like, well, there it is. That's what actually happened. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly right.
I think it's interesting though, with, you know, you talked about if you can get the time. I mean, one of the things that I've although my school is obviously much smaller than yours, I think one of the things is if you add up the number of pupils that you see across the week, the idea of getting individual time with each student is almost mathematically impossible. And yeah. It's quite interesting to hear about different ways that people are using technology to try and square that circle.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to flesh that out a bit, I was chatting yesterday, our timetable is obviously coming out at the moment for next year. Someone's looking about the amount of children that they'll be teaching, and we had a sort of big conversation around Google Classroom about how that could work for him from on a week-to-week basis, so he could then find time for those students that he really needed to see one-to-one and those that he didn't. And I found that interesting that that was the conversation you wanted to start, as opposed to what am I going to do?
Yeah, panic stations.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, I think there is definitely increased awareness amongst teachers of there must be some tools that can help me here. I've been having those conversations as well with, you know, people in maths, for example, talking about how can I gather work back and things like that. And we haven't really delved very deeply into those things because I had a sense that iTunes U might be doing something. And obviously we heard last week about what they were doing as well. But we have had people in maths, for example, looking into Google Classroom. I did an assignment, a particular assessment last year with Google Classroom as well. And people are starting to explore that. And I think it's there's a lot of potential there. I think, but I don't know how you feel. I mean, in Scotland, it goes one way, but in England as well, when you're teaching kids that are going to sit actual formal external exams, how do you feel that the kind of paperless classroom world fits in with the way that they're going to actually be assessed later on?
Yeah, sure. So I'm always keen to avoid the paperless conversation, even though I know a lot of sort of colleagues and friends like to talk about it. And that's just because I think there's always an appropriate medium at the right time. Mm-hmm. And of course, we do have that exam element. And so the way we've transitioned is that whilst people are still using the workflow platforms that you and I would tend to favour, there's an awful lot of handwritten work that is then either photographed or, you know, scanned to PDF or whatever it might be, and then that's submitted. And that's just because they need their hand to be up to speed from March, April, because they are going to be writing for an awful long time. So those skills still exist. I just find it interesting that as we go towards IB levels, you know, sixth form level, 17, 18-year-olds, extended essays, there's an awful lot more typing in there. All the feedback is given in Google Docs. And then when it comes to exams, we almost have to make sure there is enough writing going on. So it's a really tricky balance for us and something that we're very keen to maintain. And our English department are actually very crucial to maintaining a sort of grounding, both for myself and the leaders across the school.
Yeah, because they tell you when your ideas stink, don't they?
Oh, yeah.
They keep us honest. And do you know what's really interesting is also our English department have really kept me honest with electronic books as well. You know, and that's something we'll talk about. And I'd like to know how your people have felt about this as well. But we were offered an opportunity to go into a book rental system. And our English teachers told us, they said, we're not interested in that. And I said, how come, you know, we've got all these iPads, how are you not interested in electronic books? And they said, well, the iPad's too valuable to put a book on it. We want to have the iPad free to create so that we, and we'll have the book on paper. Thanks very much. And I was like, well, I'd never thought that, you know, as a committed ebook reader, I thought, well, of course you want electronic books. And then they were just nah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, iOS 9, split view.
Possibly a different story. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. So we kind of left the story there just as you had brought a MacBook into the classroom and some iPads. Can you sort of take us the next step along that story?
Yeah, so iPads and phones or whatever the guys had. A lot of the sort of early days of Socrative worked very well, particularly for me changing the pace of my lesson, which is something I'd always struggled with you know, such differentiated children in front of me, so to speak. And then I managed to persuade one of the senior leadership team at the time that we needed to try out a set of iPads. Got them going, then realized that it was working quite well for our groups for what it's worth. The value added across a year was, you know, significantly higher. For those guys, you can't separate that out as the exam result being important, but that's what it was. So we ended up taking some year sevens to have them 24/7, got their parents involved, really quite successful. I think we got it right because we just held workshops for, you know, all stakeholders like anyone would now, instead of just presenting it to them as this is what we're doing. Yeah. And then we decided to, from that sort of trial, roll it out year by year, got our infrastructure right. It worked quite well. This is all at my previous school, of course.
Of course, yeah.
So got to about 3 year groups before I left there and then moved over to Cambridge. And it was really interesting, actually, because they'd had a similar sort of time structure, but not the same approach. And between 11 to 16-year-olds at the STEAM Press Foundation, they kind of all got their iPads at the same time, having had a year of the teachers just having them. And that, with all the infrastructure problems and, you know, configurator and everything else, was quite a challenging time, as our principal talks very well about. Fortunately, we've got some great staff, some great students, and as soon as I came in, there was a couple of identifiers there, you know, choose the right cloud platform. We went with Google Apps for Education, iTunes U as a content delivery mechanism, and then we just started to work with a number of sort of key apps, all the ones you'd expect, Explain Everything, etc. And then it went out to the sixth form, and then we got 2-to-1 devices for our 7 to 11-year-olds, and sort of 3-to-1-ish for our tiny little ones, which is where we are right now. And it's interesting to reflect, we're just doing different reviews for different departments, and we're still on sort of 12 core apps, and these subjects have all got their own specific apps that they use, and the pre-prep guys, the junior school, are all flying with it all over the place, loads of really cool things happening. 7, 8, 9, lots of different experimentation with learning and expressions of learning, and then as we get to exams, we hunker down a bit and we get workflows and, you know, the odd bit that helps when appropriate.
Yeah, you sort of get to that stage where you're sort of stepping through turning a spreadsheet green over the course of a year, aren't you?
Absolutely right. Absolutely right.
Yeah, eventually, you know, you just tick, 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 tick.
And, yeah.
The job becomes a kind of checklist at some points, doesn't it?
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. So talk to me about what is digital strategy? I mean, you gave me your title here as Director of Digital Strategy. Yeah. You talked about taking a transition from I don't want to say a deployment that was in trouble, but a deployment that had challenges, and taking that into something where, you know, when I was down in London for the Apple event, you guys were being recognized as one of the leaders in certain particular areas to do with content and content delivery.
Sure.
Talk me through that.
Yeah, so I think maybe fortunately, because of my background, all of my sort of key performance indicators were not based on the technology whatsoever. So we've got sort of three strands that we hang everything off. Rightly or wrongly. The first one is to have seamless access to content. Second one is to remove barriers for learning. And then the third one, which is most important, is to ensure that teachers can do what they've always done, which is ask and answer great questions.
Okay.
And all of those things enable me to make sort of decisions based on, you know, whole school strategy or indeed subject or indeed age range, should I say. And they've been quite powerful because they are sort of statements that teachers can relate to, and they know that we're not talking about things from the digital platform. Now, it happens to be that the digital aspect often leads to either efficiencies or things that are done slightly differently. However, when they enhance learning, they take off. And I think Google Classroom is an excellent sort of example of this. I was desperate, I don't know about you, Fraser, but I was desperate to try and keep a lid on Google Classroom until it got enough features for it to be viable. And no matter what I did through the year, they were constantly on at me. Are we going to have classroom training? Can we just use it? And eventually, 3 or 4 people were using it. We turned it on inside our domain. And by the time we got to training in April, May, when we had those features released inside the app as well as through the browser, they'd already been using it. So I think when it really enhances learning, it's a very powerful thing.
And so how do you deal with that situation? Because I've run into that situation as well, where some people want to really push ahead with a certain tool or a certain platform, and other people are not necessarily resisting the use of that platform, but maybe they just don't know about it, or they're not in a position to adopt it at that point in the year or whatever. Do you then have a kind of period of reunification, or do you sort of try and take a lead after people have proven something for you? How does that kind of work?
So we've got a couple of rubrics just to confirm whether or not something is worthwhile taking forward, as anyone would. But we kind of pride ourselves on the fact that if it's right for your learning in the classroom, then it's okay. So we've still got a couple of Edmodo groups running, even though they've sort of they're dying off a little bit. There's iTunes U across the school, but there's also Google Classroom. There's even just shared Google Drive folders from pre-classroom days, and it's okay to use all of them. And what I've found is that our students, inside the iPad, it doesn't matter which box they press on, they're happy with it. So when you're tapping an app icon, whether you're going to use Classroom with a certain teacher, and the next class you're going to use iTunes U, that's okay. And that's something that I've learned quite quickly at my sort of new school, if you like, that it's okay not to have completely unified platforms. That said, I am very happy to sort of say that once you've got over those initial teething problems of wireless and structure and everything else, people really want to come to you with their ideas and talk them through because they can see the potential. And I think when you're first starting out on this sort of journey, you're always the one driving it. And that's very difficult to sort of push through when you get, you know, you get a lot of pushback from people saying, no, that's, we've always done it this way, et cetera. Yeah. And it is quite difficult to manage. But yeah, we're no sort of one true line, if you like, across the foundation.
That's really interesting because I know there are some schools and indeed or units bigger than the school where unification is like the most important thing, like having an absolutely completely uniform stack from top to bottom is considered to be the absolute holy grail of deployment. And we're kind of like you, I suppose, in the sense that we mostly have iTunes U. Most people have adopted iTunes U to a greater or lesser extent, but some people are looking for more or different. And sometimes they just have different requirements. Like in the French department, for example, they've got tools. Quizlet, I think, is one that they use, which I don't think is used anywhere else in the school except in French. But the kids, you know, my daughter's in that class, and you know, she says, "Well, in French we do this. This is how we do French. This is how we do maths." Is, you know, my maths colleague is doing the Google Classroom stuff, and then iTunes U over here and paper over here. And I agree with you that I think that there are some things that are good to have as a baseline. But there are other things that are can be more flexible. And I think the thing is, you always depend on, I don't know if you agree with this or not, but there's always a common platform somewhere. But whether it's in the cloud or whether it's the device is a common platform, and the cloud services can change, or if the devices change, the cloud service has to be consistent. It seems to me there's got to be something common somewhere.
Yeah.
But kids are flexible.
I couldn't agree more. And isn't it great that, you know, 5-6 hours of school, a child can now experience all these different mechanisms and expressions of learning and content delivery, meaning that their day is a change. I mean, I don't mind admitting, for almost a decade of my teaching, I was pretty much a content deliverer from the front with a bit of Q&A and then do an exam question. You know, that's the way I was taught. That's the way I did it. Yeah. And I reflect now on what I see the 17-year-olds doing in my school, and I think, oh, things have moved on, and I think that's fantastic. So, yeah, I'm all for the sort of whatever works is fine, but I do agree getting that structure right. So the Google Apps and the Google Docs, Google Drive structure for us is really that commonality, particularly as it runs our pastoral system and all your meetings and everything. So everyone feels very comfortable with it. And I think that makes people feel a little bit more secure that we're not going to run off and do something new all the time.
Yeah, I think it's very important to kind of give people that confidence, because I know, you know, teachers are always they want a multi-year payoff for any investment of time, you know.
Yeah, that's nicely put, yeah.
Yeah, they want like a 10-year amortization for this single worksheet that they made, you know. so we used Basecamp for a number of years before Google Docs became kind of the thing that we have switched to as well. So a lot of our, you know, organizational stuff happens in Google Docs. I would say the kids are still primarily using iWork and sharing that with teachers and things. But Google Docs is starting to come in. I'm starting to see kids more and more choose to use it themselves because they recognize certain benefits from that platform that they will get in a, you know, the classic problem of, you know, two kids work together and one of them's off sick today and they had all the data on their iPad.
Yeah.
That problem gets solved for them quite nicely by Google Docs.
That's right. And you know you're onto that win when you're here in the corner of a meeting room that two teachers are just sharing a Google Doc with their colleague who's unfortunately unwell and there's something gone on it, and then they realise what they've got to do and off they go. And they don't even realise that those things that they were worried about a year and a half ago are now working very well for them. And you sort of sit there sort of like, okay, we're getting there.
That snowball's starting to take its own its own path down the hill, isn't it?
Yeah. I think it's interesting as well. Sorry, Fraser. It's just coming to a school like Steam Post Foundation, you know, a selective school right in the centre of Cambridge, there weren't really any drivers for change. You know, great vision from the principal, who I know you've heard speak, and the fact that this was the right thing to do for a number of different reasons, but grade definitely wasn't the driver.
Yeah,
and so that itself, I always reflect that poses problems for me, because these teachers are, you know, the great teachers. They've always done well, knowing what they've known for many years, and there's a vision from the leader of the organization, but they don't need to do it for different reasons. Whereas my previous school, you know, that value added, that differentiation in every class, that was obvious. And so maybe teachers thought, right, I actually need something to help me with this position. And it's been really interesting to work in both those environments to get to almost the same sort of outcome.
it's interesting, firstly, that two different schools can converge in a very similar outcome at the end of the day for different reasons, but the result is the same. But I'm very interested in that whole question of how do you get high-performing schools to adopt massive new ideas like this? I've certainly worked with a number of schools in that situation where they are essentially just, you know, production lines for Oxford and Cambridge, and that is how they sell their school to parents. And there is no appetite whatsoever for anything that will interrupt that pipeline in any way. It's a real challenge. In fact, more of a challenge.
I think you've got to do a lot of work with the parents there as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a lot easier now because obviously these students have had them for 3 years or so. But when the new intake come, we don't give them the devices for the first few weeks so they can settle in anyway. Mm-hmm. And then when we have that meeting, we immediately offer two more workshop evenings so that the parents can come and experience what the children are going to experience. Mm-hmm. And I think that works quite well to sort of ease their pain and just how simple things are going to be. And we're not just going to give them this device that will take over all of their time, and their screen time will be, you know, through the roof, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera. Mm-hmm. And I know we both speak an awful lot about everything being front-loaded with effort. Mm-hmm. And if you, you know, if you look on Twitter and the amount of people that are going through that initial change and they're moving from laptop sets or iPad sets to a one-to-one environment, they're going through that sort of painful transition of everything seems like there's a little barrier somewhere.
Yeah.
And I guess the advice is just to keep going because it is the right thing to do, so people will get there.
Yeah, I mean, the describing it as the right thing to do is interesting because it's challenging to articulate exactly why it's the right thing to do. Sure. I don't know if you find this, but I suppose I always fall back on the idea that the computer is the fundamental intellectual instrument of our time.
Mm.
And for me, it sort of remains as simple as that, that, you know, nobody in the world, you know, we want our kids to be, you know, in the professions, we want our kids to be achieving, but even if you're not going to be a doctor or a lawyer or, you know, I've just named two jobs that perhaps are less impacted by technology than many others, but, you know, we want our kids to be in at whatever level, but even, you know, you walk around the world now and you see people using iPad everywhere. You know, you go onto a British Airways flight and they're checking the passenger manifest on an iPad. Yeah. I was walking in the supermarket and there's people stacking the shelves with an iPad in their hand, you know, and it seems to be that, you know, this mobile technology is what is becoming the fundamental work tool for a much broader section of society than the PC ever was a work tool for them.
Absolutely. I think we have to look at, so there's a couple of banks that are trying to pop up, so they don't actually have any over-the-counter services and it's all going to be done on mobile. I think there's one up in Durham at the moment, and there's reasons why businesses are going this way. And, you know, we're in education and there's some value to it that I know we see, but I think people really seriously have to look at how they can do it and then look at people that are being successful because the children do benefit. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, if you just look at grades, and obviously that's the wrong question.
Yeah, I was that exact phrase was used by your principal when I heard him speak. And I thought, well, that's a very interesting thing to say from a school that is doing really well in that respect, you know, that is known for grades. And to say that that's the wrong question is incredibly bold.
Yeah, it's quite.
Leadership move, you know, and I think that's the kind of fresh thinking that we need. You know, I think it's not all about grades, but it's not all not about grades either. You know, it's not that grades don't matter either, you know, because that's a signaling mechanism for the rest of society. You know?
And I think there's that other aspect to it, particularly with the sort of high-performing schools, is there's going to be this huge cost, however you do it, to get the devices in and the infrastructure up to speed. Granted, there might be offset costs from that. But there's also the resourcing costs. And I think that's something that a lot of schools don't get right. So the fact that I'm part of the SLT, whenever I speak to a curriculum leader, they know that what they're saying is actually being heard and can be conveyed, as opposed to it being a conversation with someone who is just trying to lead on the project, but also do a, you know, 80% timetable at the same time. Mm-hmm. And also it's that sort of learning technologist, educational technologist on the ground, helping out as required. Mm-hmm. I think that's something that tends to go by the by for quite a while. And it ends up being the sort of IT add-on, or someone can kind of fudge their way into it, but will only be available for 2 hours across a week. And things are just much more difficult in that sense.
Yeah, and particularly when you're operating at larger scale, you've got to really address that role as something that is actually formalized. I mean, I kind of get away with it at Cedars because we are so small. But when you scale up, you really have to think about taking people, you know, off timetable or whatever. And I had this conversation just a couple of shows ago in the podcast about who is it that you put into that role? Is it somebody with a technical background or somebody with an education background? And what's the balance there? Tricky one to get right.
Absolutely. And I've been lucky enough to have some IT guys who have been great in both schools. And if it wasn't for them, obviously, I would have found it much trickier with my background.
Yeah, I mean, there are certainly some IT people who are just openly hostile to the idea of any progress in this area whatsoever.
That is a whole other show. But
yes, yeah, it is. And it is a whole branded show in itself. It's not just one episode. Yeah. Let me take a minute to tell you about Jam Software. Jam Software provide ICT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies such as Mac, iPad, iPhone, and Apple TV in education. And now with Casper Focus, they've placed these great technologies directly into the hands of the teachers who work with students every day. Casper Focus allows teachers to quickly gain students' attention, conduct secure exams within an app, select the specific Apple TV assigned to their class, choose and distribute iBooks, and even start AirPlay right from Casper Focus. Learn what else you can do with Casper Focus at jamsoftware.com. So, Dan, talk to me about iTunes U and iBooks Author. You guys have received a lot of praise from Apple and from other people as well about what you've done with that, and it seems to be very comprehensive. So talk me through that.
Yeah, I feel like I'm going to unveil some secrets which are going to make me to look bad. But I think this is a good time to do it because it's actually quite simple, as you know. And what we did was resource it correctly at the start so the output could be so high. So it's quite a simple process. There's an initial, this is iTunes U, should I say, to start with. There's an initial conversation between myself and the curriculum lead as to what aspects of the curriculum would work well with a new content delivery mechanism compared to whatever was in the BLE or whatever resources there were. And that conversation is centered around how many resources are there, in what format do they need them, what are they trying to do with them. And then when we've scoped that out, we would take for a subject area that content, and a scheme of work and whatever content is available would then go to our educational technologist. In our case, it's a lady called Ashleen Brown, who's absolutely phenomenal. And I think if we could probably add her Twitter name to things for the show, people would like to get in touch with her. And she would curate an iTunes U course for them under all the headings, make it very simple for them to see. There would be a product there, and then that would be given back to that teacher or the curriculum lead to refine, put some command words in, talk about the examples that they want to give for the students. So there was an end product in a very quick turnaround. And that really worked because schemes of work are as they are. They're quite easy to hang things off inside iTunes U because we refer to iTunes U as a living scheme of work anyway. And it's amazing just how many resources exist in a department. I mean, some departments, you know, even though they're very well resourced and they talk to each other, they don't necessarily all share resources because they don't like to tread on each other's toes. When you bring that together, you can get some very rich content. So that mechanism over 6 months happened for most subject areas where it was appropriate. And we got to sort of 100 courses very quickly with a few checks and balances along the way. And that was really quite powerful from an iTunes U perspective.
Did you find any subject areas that you just thought were just not appropriate for that kind of delivery?
Yeah, I think maths. So maths ended up being like a revision exercise in the first instance.
Okay.
I think that's because, and rightly, the teachers felt that maths is all about practice. They liked the concept of something like math space, for example, but they were quite keen to always have things done pen and paper in the classroom where they could interact with it, whereas the delivery of materials wasn't quite the same. Whereas you go to the other end of the scale on something like geography, those courses that were made 18 months ago are now so rich of content, we're talking about whether we should divide those courses or we should, you know, scale them down or retitle them or whatever it might be. And I think it just lends itself to the type of teaching that goes on when the content needs to be referred to, when it needs to be made notes on. And I think that's where areas of the school are developing. So I would say maths is probably towards the bottom end of iTunes use and your sort of your arts and humanities are at the other side.
That's interesting. The whole question of how big should an iTunes U course be is something that I think I've certainly gone both ways on that question many times. And I'm kind of swinging back the other way now to looking at it more as a kind of way of collecting individual units together. And then, you know, I'll enroll the kids into four different units for this year, kind of like picking from a menu, if you like, you know. And other people have advocated, you know, doing the whole year group, the whole year in one course. Tricky balance, mate.
And I wonder what you think about, you know, now with 3.0, we've got assignments. I know you've been playing around with it. I just wonder how that will work. Because the way I see 3.0 without having used it extensively with the children is if I had a whole iTunes due course as one, that assignment workflow will work for me. Because everything that they need is in one place. If I was to split those iTunes due courses up, yes, okay, that would work as long as I kept going with it. But because we've got GAFE and we've got a lot of resources floating around in there, I'm not sure. I don't know where you stand with the 3.0.
I think one of the things that drives you one way or the other on this question is the role of the gradebook in iTunes U. Because I think looking at it, you know, it would be nice to look at that one panel as being the dashboard for the year for that class, and you can see all the assignments in there. But on the other hand, the reason I'm kind of going back to a more modular approach is because year on year, I may end up doing different things in a different order with different groups. And that's partly an artifact of small school teaching, where you may have combined classes in some years and other years you have them separately. So it's not as if I can drop down the same four modules for, you know, year six or year seven or year eight or whatever. Every single year of my career, I can't do the same thing every time. So I feel like I need that little more flexible approach. But I can see, you know, either way, I think the assignment workflow probably is going to work okay. It's just going to be a matter of how do you see an overview of the data?
Yeah, because I was having a chat with a physics teacher just the other day, and she showed me something in classroom. All of her comments weren't going as comments inside the Google Doc. They were going on the outside, just underneath the assignment. So when she downloaded to a CSV for Excel, she would not only get all the children's names, she would get the grade and the comment on the outside. So when it came to referencing for parents' evening, or indeed popping it into Idocio as our teacher planner, it was all there in one download click. So you could download all assignments and have every assignment for a child right in front of you, and you could manipulate it any which way you like. And she is sticking with that and was very keen to tell me so. And I thought, yeah, that's a great use of it.
Yeah, I can see that being an interesting issue with iTunes U, because it only gives you the numerical grades. All the additional commentary and back and forth is kind of locked up inside the course and is not really easily extracted. So that may be something that is a question. I mean, the kids will see it. So it's not an instructional question as much as a kind of school management question, I think.
Absolutely.
It's something that could be enhanced, I guess, over time. Yeah. So fingers crossed.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so on.
It's quite.
Let me tell you about Shobi. Shobi is an iPad app for paperless classrooms. With Shobi, teachers can quickly and easily assign, collect, and review student work on their iPads, then provide rich feedback to students by adding annotations, text notes, and voice notes directly onto documents. Students can show their learning creatively by submitting to Shobi from thousands of compatible iPad apps, or by completing assignments with Shobi's built-in tools. Shobi keeps everyone organized with individual student assignment folders, email, and push notifications. Shobi Basic is completely free, and teachers can try it out with their students in just a few minutes. Get started by downloading Shobi on the App Store or by visiting shobi.com. Shobi is also offering a special deal for school admins listening to this podcast. Buy Shobi Pro for 5-year teachers, and they'll upgrade an extra 5 teachers to Shobi Pro for free. That's a total of 10 teachers and all their students on Shobi Pro for a full year. Visit shobi.com/outofschool for details. So that's iTunes U. What about iBooks Author? How much are you taking? And I suppose my bigger question is, where does the dividing line lie between what goes into iTunes U and what goes into iBooks Author? I'm assuming you've done something with iBooks Author. I mean, my solution to that is not to do anything with iBooks Author.
Yeah, that's right. So we've gone the other way, actually. So our iBooks Author strategy is actually based on making our content not only available for our students, but also for anyone else, and free at the point of use. So we had one project, which is to cover the IGCSE biology course, which was pointed at our students. We have a very talented young man, Alex Van Dyke, who's authored those, and it was our educational technologist's role to put those together in iBooks Author and make them as good as they can be, and see how it turned out. And they are available to download for free on the iBook store, and we're very proud of them. And most importantly, our learners love the fact that they can see content and then use the multi-touch features to enhance that when their teacher isn't around. Mm-hmm. And so because of those, which we released last January, we've then gone about or set about doing a French module at GCSE level, and that's for speaking and grammar. Okay. And using some of the assets that you can in iBooks Author to try and enhance the learning experience, particularly for those who need to practice over and over again, so they need to hear the accents, etc.
Yeah.
And that's gone quite well, and they'll be published again in September. So I think the iBooks authoring projects will continue, because what we're finding is that staff are very keen to not only produce this content for their learners, which they are doing anyway for the new qualifications that are coming out over the next 2 years, but also the fact that it can be so multi-touch and interactive because we have some expertise on site. So I think we'll continue to pursue that and see where it takes us.
Okay. So if I understand correctly, you're saying that you take an iTunes U course and you're sort of storing it in an iBooks Author? Is that right?
No, sorry. Oh. No. So iTunes U is separate. No, this is content that they're producing themselves.
Okay.
So actually, they're iBooks pamphlets each one. So a typical textbook would actually be 12 of these sort of iBooks pamphlets, if you like.
Okay.
There's 5,000 or 6,000 words in there written by the teacher, and then loads of ideas put in for the interactive elements using bookery widgets, etc.
Right. So your students would use both the textbook and the iTunes U course together.
And then we just link to the book from the iTunes U course, which are also available publicly. Should anyone want to sort of see the learning transition? I think that's a very important thing as well for a school like ours. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're doing this anyway. This content is being written for our students, however it comes out.
Yeah.
There are links to different things happening. Why wouldn't we just publish it so other people can take advantage at a time when, you know, money is very tight in many, many schools. We're struggling away. And if we're going to go with these devices, we might as well have some free content out there, which is worthwhile. And it's a challenge as well to the sort of publishing industry to see that, okay, if we can make this sort of thing at our level, then maybe we can enhance those textbooks that are on the iBook store as we see them.
Well, I can certainly get behind that movement.
Mm.
I got this paper textbook last year, which was, it was copyright 2013, and it made reference to AppleWorks inside it. So,
oh, wow.
It was amusing because on the day that I first taught that page in the textbook, it was the 10th anniversary of the last update to AppleWorks on that day, just as it happened. So,
it makes you wonder, doesn't it? It just makes you wonder.
And this was a book that also had a page about emerging technologies, in which it included things like Instant Messenger and podcasts.
Wow.
So, yeah, that's kind of what we're dealing with textbooks, I suppose.
And I heard you speaking to Patrick last week, I think.
Yeah, Patrick Ford.
And just, you know, what is his book, 2013?
Mm-hmm.
And you just see some of the things he said in there about, you know, your deployment and everything. You're thinking, well, you know, that's so far away from where it is now.
Mm-hmm.
But for some reason, in the educational content world, there are some areas where they think, okay, let's just leave it. Let's just push this out and PDF it and everything will be fine. They think, wow, come on, what are we doing?
I'll tell you a story from a number of years ago when we first had people come into the school and push us for electronic books. Was I think it was Oxford University Press, perhaps. They've got this remedial reading scheme, whose name I forget, but they had made it into apps, and it was such a kind of quick job that literally the last page of the app actually had a barcode on the page. And I realized quite quickly that it was literally just they'd taken the PDF master of the book they sent to the press and wrapped it up in a sort of crappy,
wow,
not quite as good version of iBooks, and they were trying to sell this for like $4.99 a pop on the store. It's like,
it's amazing, isn't it? I mean, just on that sort of content push, because obviously device agnostic going forward a few years, I'm just wondering what sort of software is going to catch up with the sort of iBooks author authoring process.
Yeah.
You know, there's some really rich tools in there. And if you look at the others, you know, the Microsoft one that is, you know, arguably getting a little better, the Kindle generator, I just wonder where you sort of stand on the book publications going forward for schools or indeed publishers.
Yeah, I have so far kind of kept us out of that in the sense that I've deliberately, not obstructed is the wrong word, but I have dissuaded people from spending a lot of school resources on either buying or, I suppose, creating electronic texts of that kind of proprietary nature. Even with iTunes U, what I'm encouraging teachers to do is to use, say, Google Docs or something to write their content and then copy and paste it into an iTunes U structure so that they've got it in a way that can be extracted in the future. And it's certainly, you know, I kind of feel like all the companies are sort of, they're not deliberately necessarily locking people in, but they are clearly trying to make their software stack an enhancement to their platform primarily, and probably Apple more so than anybody else, partly because I guess Apple's got more territory to defend, whereas other people are on the attack. So things like iTunes U, iBooks Author, you know, once you get a lot of content in those structures, it becomes it was one of the main oppositions I encountered to the idea of us potentially changing to Chromebook. Was, well, I've done all this work in iTunes U, can I get access to that on the Chromebook? And the answer is, of course, no. And therefore, that's the end of that conversation for a lot of teachers. Because we're only 2 years into their 15-year payoff for that work that they're expecting to get.
Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah, so we all our assets are in Drive folders, regardless, as you'd expect. And I think it's an easy decision for us because the school was iPad anyway. The iPad iteration process hasn't really let us down in terms of it being the best tablet. We really like it as a form factor for the learning that we do. So from that point of view, it was okay, but we've been very careful to make sure that there's that backup that exists.
Yeah, you've got to have an exit strategy, which might not be free, right? No exit strategy, I think, is really free. I mean, we had this conversation, Bradley and I, about what happens if Google Docs and Drive go away. And there is an exit strategy there, which is export it to Word and Excel. But, you know, that's not a non-trivial amount of effort, but it is at least a path that will work.
Sure.
Yeah. Let me tell you about XMA. This episode is sponsored by XMA and the HP Chromebook 11 and 14. Chromebooks have instant-on, security built-in, long battery life, the best of Google, and access to thousands of educator-approved apps in the Chrome Web Store. XMA brings over 30 years' experience in the UK education market to their All Learn program, a proven framework for deploying devices in education that covers everything from planning, cultural impact, and finance options to infrastructure and management. Working with XMA as an HP partner means you get a choice of great Chromebook devices and all the support you need directly from XMA. Visit xma.co.uk or follow them on Twitter at @wearexma. Thanks to XMA and HP for sponsoring this show. Right, so talk to me about your other topics of interest, you know, what beyond just content delivery, removing barriers to learning, empowering teachers, what else is on the horizon for you? What are you interested in for the future?
Yeah, so the other, it's all about inspiration and engagement for us, because we do have some very able students, and it's interesting you mentioned the sort of doctor lawyer aspect. That tends to be, you know, Oxbridge is the path, doctor lawyer, that sort of. Well, and Tricia, the principal, is very keen to emphasize there are many different careers out there. So the inspiration and engagement is something we've been really looking at. And that really starts at the very sort of the younger years. And so consequently, we got involved in a conversation about iBeacons, which when I first heard about it, I was very skeptical. But the more we've looked at it and the more we've worked with it, it really does sort of point towards a very different way of learning. And I know you've had a little look at beacons in some sort of context, but my first exposure to it really was, well, I'm here, I'm running an app, and therefore the beacon will talk to that app and I will see some content. And I thought, well, that's all very well, but we've got iTunes U courses and iBooks, so we're fine. And as we've worked through the year, we realized that you could integrate Google Drive into this, and you could also use your Google user groups to assign content to people. So every single one of our Google user groups, including the individuals, you can post content to via Beacon technology. And that started to get me thinking in a great way. So I guess for anyone who doesn't really know about Beacon sort of content or Beacon in education, your iPhone can be a Beacon, and it can talk to the iPad as long as they're running the school app. And the best way I can think of describing it is I can walk into my classroom, and my iPhone, because it's near the iPads, will say to six iPads for six certain students, you see this content, please. Another eight students, you see this content. And these 10 students over here, you see this content. And that happens just because I've walked into the room and my iPhone is talking to the iPads. Okay. And the reason why that's of great interest is because I spent many years trying to work out a way of starting lessons, which was an appropriate level for all students. Mm-hmm. And I never made it. You know, I even had QR codes on the walls for different mm-hmm. videos that we were going to see. And here I am, having sort of preloaded all that content, just walking into a room and they've all got something different to look at. Mm-hmm. And that is of great interest to me, because mm-hmm. I think that's something that works very well in a mixed environment. You're yeah. trying to engage students at the start of a lesson.
Mm-hmm. You can see that maybe filtering down also to younger years as well, where you may have group-based yeah. work. And it's something yeah. we're not struggling with, but trying to get our head around, I suppose, is how do you deal with multiple level teaching in the same classroom? So that's kind of a feature yeah. of the new Scottish exams, is that, you know, you can have two, potentially three, and I've met people who are doing four different levels inside one classroom in one scheduled hour. And I don't know how you do that without technology support. I really don't.
No, absolutely right. Yeah. Actually, that probably points to it. So we've set up a lesson where a teacher wouldn't necessarily have to talk, just mm-hmm. to see what it would be like with the speaking technology. And it's based on tasks. So it's almost like a treasure hunt, but they don't have to go anywhere to do it. It can all come from one beacon.
Okay.
If that makes sense. So the first bit of content that pops up on the device, because they're near a beacon or near the iPhone or whatever it might be, is just to see a video, read a bit about something, and then maybe perform an action, like taking a photo or something. That then leads into task two, which is to open the Pages document and fill out this sheet and then send that via Google Classroom. Third one would be to interact with the environment. So as you move towards something, whatever the filter is or whatever the say you're in a biology classroom and you're looking at the eye would change as you were near it because it needed to show you something.
Okay.
So the next task is a Keynote file where there is five preloaded slides and they have to input different information into that. And then the fifth one, is to make and explain everything using the sensor beacon, which can take all the data, etc. So it's all really quite exciting stuff. And the whole point of that is people could move through those tasks and receive the next task when they've completed one. Meanwhile, the teacher can be in helping or guiding, enhancing the learning in a different way whilst that class is going on. And I've never come across anything like it, which means that I have to kind of pursue it to get it to a level where I'm sort of interested that the teachers in our school will really want to grab it, because if it's just delivering content, mm-hmm. we're pretty good with that already.
And so what does the workflow look like for creating that kind of pathway? Is it, you talked about a school app, would you build it in the school app? Does that have to be the driver?
Yeah, so it's all, so Lockly.com, Locly, is where you can build your own school app, which is a beacon app.
Okay.
And essentially sort of a semi-automated process. And you have the ability to do everything through a web browser.
Okay.
So everything from put your animation on to adding content. So each of those content delivery things that I just mentioned are all inside a card, and that mm-hmm. card is attached to a project and a place.
Okay.
So I want to put a picture on this project, on this beacon, and that will go to 7A, and I do that on a dashboard. So 7A will see this, I put the picture in, ping, and then off it goes.
Okay.
It's available. And that can be so when I get near to the students, or it can be that you send a direct notification. Mm-hmm. What is interesting is you can put a time on that, so it's only available from 10 o'clock to 10:05, let's say, in a certain room,
okay.
On a beacon around the school. Or once they've seen the content, it just disappears and they can never see it again, no matter how many times they walk past that beacon.
Okay.
So, all based on cards. It's all web-based. I think there's another element to this as well, which is the parental engagement.
Mm-hmm.
So there's two things you can do. You can send an email to the parents. They can download the school app. They then become an ad hoc Google user group inside. So if I wanted to message 7A's parents about a great piece of work, take a picture of the work, put it into a card, and then just ping them that work if they wanted to see it. And also you can pair a parent's smartphone to the iPad of the child. So I take a little video of Emily doing something amazing in my PE lesson. I attach that to a card and send it just to Emily. Emily then I attach that bit of content to the beacon at the front of the school. Emily's iPad goes past the front of the school as she leaves school. Mm-hmm. It just remains as a notification. When she gets home, she can open up that notification. But as soon as she arrives on her home wireless, it pings onto their parent's smartphone and they can see it too. And that everything there can happen with me doing very little. And that is of great interest to me.
That's the key, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely right. And you know, we talk about all the factors that are involved with great learning, and teaching great, and feedback is one of them, and parental engagement and support is another. And I just think the fact that we can engage very simply, if we get it right, is something worth pursuing. So we'll continue to take a look.
Interesting. I must look into that. I hadn't heard of that website before.
Yeah, so it's all brand new. We've been working with Lockley for a year now to try and get away from the kind of treasure hunt. I just go here and I see something else, and it's really quite exciting. And they've got some great blogs and how-to videos on there.
Interesting. Great. Well, we'll stick a link to that in the show notes, and I'm sure people will be interested in checking that out.
Yeah, absolutely.
What do you use for physical beacons, just out of interest?
So Lockley have got their own, and there's some Estimote ones around. And there's a new one, a sensor beacon from Texas Instruments that we got over that can pick up all your light, temperature, etc., and that works very well.
Okay.
It's quite incredible, actually. So some of the scientists are getting very excited about the fact that this thing that costs £20 is going to replace some of the things that cost £300. But
that's quite interesting, the idea of a beacon embedded in a larger piece of technology.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that too much. I mean, the one I've seen before is, you know, like there's a beacon stuck on the front of a printer, and as you walk up to the printer, your device gets configured for that printer or whatever.
But
there are definitely more interesting things that can be done with it than that.
That's right. And we're with Maru and Casper as our MDM, and they have the sort of beacon integration, so you can have zones all across your school. Mm-hmm. So as long as the beacons are close enough, when you're in a zone, you have a certain profile on your device. And you can be, you know, forced to download apps or whatever it might be, or indeed get a different profile for different filtering. And that's of great interest as well, because, again, it just makes life easier.
My classic joke example there is when there's a beacon in the boys' toilet that turns off the camera for the iPads. Yeah.
Okay, well, I'll just make a note of that for one of our profiles.
Yeah, perfect. You can use that one. That idea is
free. Thanks very much.
My beacon research completely failed because I bought the cheapest ones from Amazon, which were basically impossible to configure. So they're sitting in a drawer doing nothing right now. I should have spent on the Estimate ones, I think.
Yeah, and they're coming down. And if you buy a little bit in bulk, they come, you know, we're talking about £10, £7 or so. But the great thing is all the devices are beacons. So you don't need any at all to get going.
Yeah.
As long as you get the right interface. So, yeah, I can recommend it.
Yeah, cool. You mentioned also to me iOS 9 earlier, and I know you're quite enthusiastic for some of the things that are coming there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's worth noting that we were just about to, half our guys are on iPad Airs and half are on 4s, and we came to the 2-year refresh, and we stopped it as soon as we heard about the iOS 9 coming out, because we were going to just put our 4s onto Airs. We couldn't see the point of getting Air 2s.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, split view apps
suddenly
come along.
Reason. Yeah.
And if you've got, you know, over 100 iTunes U courses and a load of books in production, you're thinking, hang on, Air 2 or Pro has got to be the way to go. So we just had to stop it. Just interestingly, actually, sent a message out to parents to say, look, this is why we're doing it. And it wasn't one bit of comeback. So, okay, that makes complete sense. No problem at all. We could stick with the 4s for a little while we work out what's coming for Christmas, which I was very pleased about. But then that leads us to that horrible conversation that you've only got a 64 gig Air 2 and the cost of that, and you can't get a 16 obviously, the cost of that compared to an Air 32 is really quite something. So that's a little source of a frustration of mine, but there we go.
Yeah, I guess we have to hope that the September refresh this year pushes everything down a generation,
such that the
Air 2 becomes the Air that you're looking at today, you know.
I
don't think we need 64s necessarily. We've been using 32 fourth generation, you know, the ones that half your school are on. We've had them for 2 years. And we'll have them for one more year because we're in a 3-year cycle. And certainly, I completely agree with you that until the announcement of iOS 9, I was looking at iPad Air as being the no-brainer choice between the Air and the Air 2. But iOS 9 changes everything in that equation.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. And actually, when speaking to teachers, this is another interesting part. When you've had devices in your school for long enough, you can have those conversations and people immediately understand what you're saying and are very happy with that. And that again was very interesting to be able to talk about iOS developments and it not be a big announcement that I'll be doing in September that this is coming, don't do it until we've done it and all this. And now everyone just kind of understands what's going on. I also think the trackpad is interesting because that's a little buggy at the moment on the sort of trial device. But I assume that's going to get a little bit slicker. And you know, that's one of the big bugbears I have inside Google Docs on an iPad. And I think that might work really well.
Yeah, you're talking about the two-finger text selection gesture you can do on the keyboard.
Mm.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you know that's going to kill off a lot of third-party keyboards. The fact that they don't do that, and Apple's keyboard does. Although I don't know what you see, but I certainly there was a lot of enthusiasm for new keyboards in the early days, and I think most kids I see now are back to the Apple keyboard.
Absolutely, it's not like Apple to kill off a few people just like that with one operating system upgrade, is it?
They would never do such a thing. although some of those keyboards, I think, have to be killed.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Although I do like the one for our younger ones with the lowercase letters. That was always a...
Yes, we use that one too. Yeah,
absolutely.
It's although that's, that, you know, in iOS 9, there's going to be... the Apple keyboard will change to lowercase if lowercase is what you're typing as well. So it's good times. I mean, I think the iOS 9 release has primarily been a big gift to people like you and I who are big iPad users in their jobs. And I think that completely changes the dynamic of what you're going to refresh to. And certainly fingers crossed that, you know, if the iPad Pro does appear, that the iPad Air gets a nice price cut as well. The Air 2 gets a nice price cut, I should say.
Yeah, and then we're going to get into a really difficult conversation with sort of age-appropriate use for the device.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine the Air 2 will suffice for most students up to at least 16.
Yeah.
It'd just be interesting to see what the Pro... I mean, there's that scalable... The keyboard is scalable, right, in iOS 9. So that's... I mean, it's got to be happening for Christmas. So they would be missing a trick, I guess, if they didn't release it then. So that conversation will be quite tricky, depending on how much more money it is. Because, of course, the Surface 3 Pro is quite a device with the stylus.
Yeah.
But a ridiculous price, so it's not right for education. But I think some of the technology in that is very interesting, particularly with the older students in mind.
Yeah, I mean, to me, everything about the Surface Pro 3 is interesting, except the software. But you're right. I mean, I think that if the iPad Pro comes along and it is in that territory, then it will have no relevance to education whatsoever. However, if by some Tim Cook supply chain miracle, the iPad Pro can come in at the price point of the Air 2, that would be very interesting. Now, the Air 2's price points are very wide, you know. There are very, very expensive iPad Air 2s you can buy. But we'll see what happens, I guess. And once September, October comes around, that's when, it keeps saying to the people who phone me up, I don't talk about this stuff until September happens. You know,
so
phone me back in November and we'll talk, you know.
No, absolutely. I think it's also interesting to note that it's now easier to cope with the fact that iOS 8 and the devices we have will all be fine September, October, whenever we make our decision to transition to iOS 9, not that we'll be able to stop anyone, but when we make that decision, it will be okay because everything's working for us now. It's not like we're going from 6 to 7 or anything like that. And they were quite big months, September, October, when all that sort of happened. I don't feel that now. You know, we're adding a few more features. Stability has been pretty good. But we shall see.
Yep, I was running the iOS 9 beta 1 and 2. I actually had to revert because iTunes U3 is broken under iOS 9 at the moment. There's a bug where you can't attach anything to an assignment if you're on iOS 9. I don't know why not. But,
interesting.
So I actually reverted my iPad just to do the iTunes U3 stuff over the past couple of weeks. But yeah, I agree with you that the stability was already better than I expected. In some respects, may already be better than iOS 8. I'm not sure.
Quite.
I think it's going to be a big year for iPad all in. You know, the iPhone has done the things it needs to do. It's gotten bigger, so on and so on. It's in China, which is obviously important. It feels like the iPad's about to get quite a lot of love, which is going to be nice.
Yeah. Have you had that conversation with the sort of staff level where actually some sort of MacBook or Chromebook with a 6 Plus or something would do a job? From a staff point of view?
Well, I've certainly had colleagues ask me, because I'm the only teacher in the school who's got a 6 Plus at the moment, and I've had colleagues come to me who are maybe using like an iPhone 4S, and they're saying, I've got to upgrade. Can I do everything I need to do with iOS on a 6 Plus? And right now, I think the answer is no. Sure. But it's not that far away.
Right.
You know, I think one of the things is, iTunes U Course Manager, which is available on the iPad, is not. Even an iTunes U3 is not on the phone at all. So that would be a big gap if you didn't have an iPad as such.
Absolutely.
But I've certainly seen over the past year, more of my work has gone into, Google Docs on the Mac, or I'm using my phone. And the iPad has kind of dwindled a little bit over the past year, but I can definitely see that picking up again as I kind of refocus on iTunes U, I think. I'm not saying I fell off the wagon with it this year, but I certainly explored other opportunities, shall we say. You know, we did the Classroom project. Yeah. We did a thing with a pure Google Drive submission as well. But I can see myself coming back to it more.
Yeah, I'd agree. I did the whole, you know, only use your phone for a month type stuff. And actually, it's surprising. But then in a role where you're not teaching sort of 80% of the time, maybe that's slightly different, you know, with all the meetings, et cetera, and other different things that you have to do. But yeah, it is an interesting time. I'm really interested in our digital leader feedback when iOS 9 is out and they've used it for a couple of weeks in their classes and how the different views are working for them. And I think they'll be the most important sort of people going forward, just because they understand the way they want to work. They've got their setup at home. And I think the iPad with iOS 9 on it will probably do pretty much everything for them when they've got apps running side by side. But we shall see.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see, just to observe behavior. You know, I think that's always, you know, working in a school is such an opportunity, I think, because you see so many people using the same technology that you use in completely different ways to the way you would ever think to use it. Some of the things that I see kids doing, like, you know, the number of kids who have got like assistive touch enabled on their iPad for some reason, you know, it's like, why would I ever turn that on when I don't need it? And they've got it turned on for whatever reason. Things like that is all very interesting.
That's right. It always makes me laugh when a teacher comes to me and say, "Well, we were using this app and two of the students didn't know how to use it. You know, they shouldn't know how to use it." So, well, hang on. Ask them to do a minute movie of their life with photos, video, audio, all smashed in, and you've only got 5 minutes to produce it, and they'll do it for you. So trust me, if you ask them to use an app, it won't take them long to work it out.
Yeah, and if it does, you're using a bad app.
A very bad app, yes. With none of the normal gestures.
Absolutely. You may be using Apple Music.
Oh, now that is another conversation. I have been trying with it. So I do a bit of biking to and from work, so I've got a nice commute. And so my Spotify playlist and everything are absolutely lovely. But I thought, you know what? It's there for 3 months. Let's have a look. Yep. It's not dragging me in at the moment.
Yeah, I've got to say, I like the idea. When I bought my last Chromebook, I got a free trial of Google Music and used that exclusively for that period. And I was pretty happy with that. Apple Music seems to do a lot more, but it's not always obvious to me how to get to all the things that it does. You know, I keep finding new things that are in there, like, oh, there's playlists for whatever mood you're in, and okay, here's playlists for when you're traveling and stuff. But I can't I can never remember how to get back to them once I've seen them once.
You're right. I think the four tabs are good. I think to go back to that rather than having everything buried is the right thing to do. But you're right, to have everything under, I mean, Beats 1 is obviously the most important thing to them, but to have everything underneath that, I mean, I never spend any time on Beats 1 at all. It's always the stuff towards the bottom. But yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure I'll be making the transition. And also Beats 1 is a bit in your face for the main radio station. I don't know whether how long you've listened to it, but
about 4
high
minutes.
High energy is how I'd put it.
Yeah, it's definitely for perhaps, shall we say, a younger demographic than you and I. Is that fair to say?
Subtly, but correctly. But.
Great. Well, Dan, I think we should wrap up there. That's been a really great discussion. It's been great to hear some of the things you're interested in, some of the things that you have experienced, some of the things you've dealt with, and also some of the things you're looking at for the future. I'm really excited to see where all this goes over the next few months.
No problem at all, and I really enjoyed it. Thanks for having me on.